Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a show about the legislative session. I'm John Pimble. At this point, it's common to hear bills entering the enrollment stage. This is when the House and Senate have approved a bill and await the governor's decision to sign it into law or veto it. Because the chambers are controlled by the same party as the governor, a veto on anything is highly unlikely. One of the bills awaiting the governor is one dealing with electronic eavesdropping. This bill had no resistance when it first passed the House and went to the Senate, where it was slightly amended. Now that it is back in the House, Democrats suddenly have privacy concerns. Greg Hartsill is the floor manager. He says this bill exempts home security monitoring from laws prohibiting electronic eavesdropping.
The capture of audio and video is for the express purpose of detecting or preventing criminal activity.
Representative Charles Eisenhardt asks Hartsill about surveillance equipment in rented spaces.
Why doesn't it say all owners and lessees instead of all owners or lessees?
Well, because it could be one or the other.
So it doesn't need to be both.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
The consent doesn't need to be both the owner and the leasers of the property. It can be one or the other.
Correct.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I misunderstood that provision in the earlier vote on this bill, and so given that information, I have more angst about it than I did before. I appreciate the clarification.
When the bill was in the Public Safety Committee, Representative Bob Cressing and Representative Hartsill were both part of a vote to advance it. Cressing now asks Hartsill to talk about the bill's progression since the time they saw it in committee.
You know, when we originally had the discussion on this bill, it was with your sheriff was here, right?
With one of the police department chiefs.
Police. Yes. Yeah. So from that day forward, okay, the bill sounded really good to mm-hmm. me. So can you take us from that day to where we're at right now? Can you do that? And hopefully
in
we can
60
all
seconds
understand
or less.
What's happened.
Well, thank you, Representative Cressig. I'll do my best to summarize this. This was an attempt to make sure that as technology gets better and, you know, a lot of folks with their home security devices typically in the past have just caught the video. Now, with the advancement of technology, our home security devices are now capturing audio. Well, the question was, is that capture of audio illegal? Because we need clarity in the code as it is right now. And so that was the concern that was brought forth by the police chief that came to our subcommittee. And in consultation with my county attorney, there was a perceived need of clarifying that in code. And so that's what we have now. Now, to bring it up to where we're at today, that was passed out of this chamber unanimously. Right. It went to the Senate. The Senate just added a little bit of language to clarify that this is for expressly for the detection or prevention of criminal activity.
All right.
So it's not just, you just can't be snooping on people just because you know, because you're voyeuristic or anything like that.
All right. Well, I appreciate that definition and description, and based on that fact, I'll probably be supporting the bill. It just seems like, of course, I know we're getting close to the end of session, and a lot of stuff happens. Doesn't necessarily include me in the conversation, but I get that, so I will more than likely support the bill, unless somebody gets up and gives me a valid point not to.
As per normal on a bill, more representatives ask floor manager Hartsill questions, including Art Stade.
You mentioned that it couldn't be for the intention of being voyeuristic or just snooping, eavesdropping on people. So my question is, when the government does something like this under the Fourth Amendment, they've got to have a good reason and talk about what they're listening to and get a warrant, that sort of thing. Why is an individual so different that they just would be able, and tell me if they can, would be able to say, well, my intention was to look for illegal thing. But in fact, that person could very well be voyeuristic and a snoop and or be looking for business secrets or other things. So how do we keep from that happening by allowing people legally to do this?
Well, Representative, by where we're clarifying or where we're defining where the placement of these monitoring devices, where these monitoring devices are being placed in the definition here, folks do not have what we've talked about in the past as a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if you're coming on to my porch of my house and I have one of these security devices and you're carrying on a conversation with someone, it would be just the so any video or audio that my home security device would intercept would be just the same as if I had my front door open and you were having the conversation and I could hear you through my screen door. So if you didn't want that conversation to be captured on my front porch, then you probably should cease that conversation because I could either hear it through my screen door or my home security device could hear it.
But right now we have a reasonable expectation to expect that not to happen. Would there not be some kind of warning device that there's video or audio being recorded? There is no requirement for that. So a person could then use this for all kinds of other reasons and say that it was for preventing law. That's my first point. My second point in here, real property. So we're talking about the leasing of real property. Would real property mean business property too? That's not defined in here. Would that be a business property?
Well, that would be commercial property as well.
Personal property, business property, would it include my ownership of a hotel or a motel?
Well, as long as it's provided, that's commercial property.
So I could listen into the conversations and record the conversations and maybe dispense with them illegally, conversations about business dealings, about secrets, about relationships, about sexting with individuals, about affairs. I could probably, because my intention is good, I'm looking for illegal things, but I could actually eavesdrop, record those, and in some cases, have videos of those. Is that correct in this? Will allow that and make that legal?
With all due respect, Representative State, I think you're looking a little too much into the details.
I don't
here.
Believe I am. I think I missed that the first time, but on this round, I'm looking at it a lot more carefully, and I believe that that is covered. It's called real property.
Right.
So that would include all of those places, including hotels, motels?
Well, commercial property in general.
I find this to be disturbing.
State says he will not support the bill. Neither will Mary Masher.
If it's at a hotel, if it's at a place where there is a perceived, you're in public and you know that, I think there could be a problem with an individual using it for ill intentions.
I'm certain that people could use home security devices for their unintended purposes. I agree with you. There is a potential for everyone to abuse anything that's sold over the counter for a certain purpose for something else. I believe we have laws on the books currently that would prohibit that. Voyeurism, window peeping,
but
what
how
have
do you.
You
do that if now we've legalized it and you don't even know who is doing that and is going to use this law as an excuse for why they think
I
it's
don't believe
okay.
That, Representative Masher, with all due respect, I don't believe we are making that okay because I floor managed a bill here a couple years ago that dealt with the whole idea of window peeping and
I remember
capturing,
that.
Okay?
I
so
remember
if you remember that.
That
bill, we pretty much...
But we have no way of monitoring that. Obviously, if we have the government doing that, if the city police or a county sheriff's department is doing that,
right.
They're doing that to protect the public. If someone else is doing that for a business location and they, again, have ill intentions, we have no way of knowing that. We have no way of monitoring what they're using that footage for. Right? Because it's their own footage. Nobody's looking at it. Nobody seems to know.
So help me out here then, Representative Masher. If there is criminal activity happening around a business owner's property.
That's where I think the police come into play, and I think you get the government involved because their goal is to protect the public.
So then the business owner doesn't, you're saying the business owner does not have the right to put up a security device on their own property to monitor that?
I am saying that there are some who may use it for ill intent, and we will never know. We won't have any reason to identify those individuals because they'll be able to keep the footage. They'll be able to use it for whatever purpose they want. And that's where I get into concerns about the way this bill is written. I'm not sure it protects those individuals.
Masher says she doesn't support the bill because it has too many unintended consequences. Liz Bennett asks Hartzell about the storage and potential distribution of surveillance files.
Is there anything in this bill that would stop somebody, maybe they did record this information in keeping with what your purposes are? Is there anything that would stop them from sharing that material with other people, putting that on websites, or using it in any other manner such as that?
Currently, whether it's a home security device or a business security, what have you, there's would be nothing that would prohibit that to my knowledge.
Okay, I gotcha. So, maybe if I was going into my apartment where I rent and, maybe I was having a conversation about my political views or how I feel about my boss or how I feel about the person I'm with, there would be nothing stopping that from being, broadcasted or shared with my employer or put on the internet.
Where were you having this hypothetical conversation? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
For example, I know we're talking about commercial properties.
Right.
So maybe I'm entering my dwelling that I rent from somebody else.
And you're outside the property, you're just starting to come into the door or something like that, and
perhaps
you're having a conversation that was intercepted by one of these security devices, and someone, let's say a business owner, were to share that publicly or more broadly. Is that your concern?
Yeah, would there be a difference, and maybe you can also clarify for me, would there be a difference between, if I was physically located inside the door of my dwelling, but this audio information was recorded by a device placed outside of my personal dwelling?
Well, I think if you're on the inside of the dwelling, and this even clarifies that this does not cover a shared hallway, so if you're inside, I believe that the video would be something that like a landlord could put up, mm-hmm. but not capturing the audio, no.
Okay, I gotcha. But either way, so I'm leaving my car, I'm with somebody, I'm going into my apartment building or something like that.
Sure.
I'm sharing political views or things like
that. Let's say it's your one of your forms and a constituent captures audio or video that you necessarily don't want to have shared. Is that protected as well?
Well, I think that that's beside the point,
okay,
because my expectation of what I can say when I'm going into the place where I live is
sure
significantly different from, what I'm saying in the venue of a forum. So,
sure.
So it sounds to me, and I'm just trying to understand because I want to make sure that I know what I'm voting for my constituents, but so if I'm going into my apartment and I'm talking, to one of my friends, or one of my friends is talking to me about how they feel about politics or their boss, my landlord could share that information with their boss or share it on the internet. Is that right?
Theoretically, I assume they could. It'd be in very poor taste, and
sure,
I would hope that landlord would lose tenants because of that. But I suppose theoretically they could.
Representative Mary Wolf says she likes the intention of this two-page bill, but it's not complete enough.
I get what this is trying to do, and I respect that. And I told Representative Hartzell it is a legitimate issue that needs to be addressed. But this bill does what we so often do here, is that we write a bill that, yeah, it fixes one issue, but it opens up all sorts of other, because it isn't drafted correctly. And I tried to fix it. And actually, the First Amendment that I suggested to Representative Hartzell, that wouldn't have fixed it anyhow. I tried to fix it before now, and I can't fix it. But anybody out there who believes in privacy and liberty and not having people intercepting and recording private communications when you are in an apartment building or in a hotel or in an office building that you lease from a the owner of the building. Again, I'm not saying they're going to do that, but we are making it legal for that to happen. And yeah, I voted yes on this the first time around, and I am not ashamed to say that sometimes I don't give each bill the full, you know, analysis that I should, and I miss this. But I didn't miss it this time, and I think everybody in the opposing party has seen it too, and it amazes me that the party of liberty and privacy rights and all of that are going to vote yes on this bill. So that's fine, and it's just going to be interesting. This will be an interesting vote to watch for me, because it kind of goes against everything a lot of these people in this room claim to stand for.
Only Representative Hartzell speaks in favor of the bill and keeps his closing remarks brief.
You know, I think there's been some misrepresentation here and even science fiction injected into the discussion, which I cannot begin to try to legislate against science fiction. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate the debate. I appreciate the conversation. I would just simply, Mr. Speaker, move that the House concur in the Senate amendment, and I ask for the body to vote aye.
The bill passes 60-38. It's awaiting the governor's signature to become law. This is Representative Greg Hartzell's last General Assembly. He is not running for re-election. This is Under the Golden Dome, an Iowa Public Radio podcast about the legislature. I'm John Pimble.
The chair now recognizes the senator from Wapello, Senator Chelgren, for opening remarks on Senate File 2394.
Senator Mark Chelgren is also in his final days as a legislator. He is not running for re-election. One of the last bills he'll floor manage involves increasing fines and penalties.
Senate File 2394 is a bill to provide truth in sentencing.
One of this bill's goals is to make it easier to understand how much you will have to pay for certain penalties. For some fines, there is a surcharge and other fees a person may not initially know about when they are fined. Senator Dan Dawson says this bill may help a defendant know what their actual financial responsibility will be.
You know, we could have someone who was charged and convicted of drug paraphernalia, a pot pipe, if you will, and they could get a $100 fine. But there's additional costs beyond that. There's the law enforcement initiative surcharge, which is $125. There's the court cost, which is $60. There's the criminal surcharge of 35%. There's the DARE surcharge of $10, which leads to a grand total of $330 on a $100 fine. This is what our system has become since 1982. Back in 82, we created a criminal surcharge of 10%. In 2003, we decided to up it to 30%, 2005, 32%, and 2009, up to the current level, 35%. Law enforcement surcharge, 2001, $125. Domestic abuse surcharge, 2015, $100. Protective order surcharge, 2015, $50. What this bill tries to do on those surcharges is that we find everything that's related to a general fund and we drive that down while raising the overall fines to what we intended on, which this the fiscal note does represent, is to something that's revenue neutral and gives the defendants some better visibility as to what their overall consequences are for their actions.
Let's throw some numbers at you. Here's an example of how a criminal penalty works now and how it could change with the bill using data from the Legislative Services Agency. Today, when someone is issued a $100 criminal penalty fine, there's a 35% surcharge. Of that surcharge, the county gets $1.75, the state gets $33.25. The state's portion breaks down to $26.69 to the general fund and $5.65 to the victim compensation fund. There is also a $60 court fee. The total a person has to pay for this $100 criminal penalty is actually $195. Here's what the bill proposes to be changed if the criminal penalty fine is $100. There will be a 10% surcharge, with $1.50 going to the county and $8.50 to the state.
Of that state money, $5.70 will go to the Victim Compensation Fund, and $2.81 now goes to the State Crime Lab Fund. Add court cost, and the total is $170. If that sounds cheaper, well, it is for a fine of $100. But fines are going up. A criminal penalty fine today at $100 will be $128, with a surcharge and court costs. The total is $203. This is how it will work for criminal penalties. Fines for just about everything will go up, some at higher percentages than others. There are other ways fines for different things will be divided amongst state and local governments. Senator Mark Shelgren explains how some fines will add to the judicial branch's technology fund.
Division 2 repeals a portion of the Enhanced Court Collections Fund that provides funds to be used by the judicial branch of Iowa Court Information Systems. It strikes the current Court Technology and Modernization Fund and rewrites it. The state court administrator is now required to allocate $9.4 million of court revenues to be deposited in the Court Technology and Modernization Fund. Under current law, the allocation was $1 million.
Senator Chalgren says presently this fund is not being used to upgrade servers and computers in the judicial branch.
If you haven't been in the justice appropriations side of this or paid much attention, that court technology fund has been used over the last few years for salaries. It's not what it should have been used for. So at the point that the technology needed the money because we had a failure, the money wasn't there. We need to make sure we clarify this and clean this up, but we need to refill that technology fund, and this is a very good, consistent way to do it. Because as years go on, we will continually need advanced technology. All businesses, and government is no different, should always strive to improve the efficiency of providing the service.
The judicial branch is one of the state departments that received mid-year budget cuts. Most of the department's budget pays for staff. With most fees and fines increasing, Senator Rob Hoag wants to remove proposed increases for civil filing fees in family law cases.
Now, we're in a legislative session here where there's been a lot of discussion about tax cuts. So people are saying, we want to cut taxes, but this bill is an increase in filing fees, and it includes an increase in filing fees for people who are getting divorced, who are modifying child custody orders, or bringing other family law proceedings in our courts. And I, for one, think that if you're trying to raise money, doing it on the backs of people who are already going through significant family law challenges is not the way to raise revenue for the state. I mean, it's basically a tax increase on people going through divorces. And so what my amendment does is say, let's just not do those fee increases. There's no need to do them. The bill as contemplated would already raise, I think, several million dollars in revenue. This part that I would take out was estimated by the Legislative Services Agency at about $380,000 fee increase on people who are trying to modify a child custody or get a divorce. People who are real Iowans experience real challenges in their lives trying to do something to make their life better. And I don't think that's how we want to raise the revenue to pay for government. I think that's wrong, especially in light of the tax cuts that are being proposed for the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest individuals.
Senator Dawson says the body should not support Senator Hoag's amendment.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about the funding levels of the judiciary. For right or for wrong, this has been a multi-year issue, but the issue came to head a few years or last fall when the EDMS electronic court server went down and we found out we had no backup. That started a conversation as to how do we provide some resources to the courts. And what we're trying to do inside of this bill is reflect that the money generated will go directly to the courts. Which is why I think that all my colleagues on the larger portions to support this bill. This amendment will undermine some of the financials that we've built up to support the technology and the backup server inside of the larger bill here. So I just want a little history here for this legislative body. We have not raised fees since 2009. I don't need to go through, you know, whose vote count was what back then, but I would say I don't believe that we are doing this on the backs of the poor and on the families that are downtrodden. Back in 2009, this legislative body raised the civil filing fees from $100 to $185, which was an 85% increase.
Hoag responds to the penalty increases from 2009.
I was here when that was done, and that was done because of a global economic recession, and we were finding a way to fund the courts. We were trying to find a way to do that. I didn't think we were in a global economic recession, and by the way, that doesn't mean it was a good thing to do in 2009, right? And now you're talking just to get in the courthouse on a divorce, $275, a $90 increase, a fee increase. And some parent who wants to go in and modify, because maybe the custodial parent's not doing a good job, or maybe they think the circumstances have changed. You're saying to them, okay, going to cost you an extra $20 just to access the courts. That's not right. We should make our courts accessible to people, not put up barriers to families that are already experiencing very hard circumstances.
This amendment fails, but Hoag proposes two more, and they pass. One would stop the fee increase for an adoption petition, and the other removes a $20 fee increase for small claims appeals. That would bring the state around $5,000 more. Before voting, Senator Chelgren says he's not sure whether he should support this amendment.
Senator Hoag, I must admit I'm somewhat torn on this amendment. I realize the fiscal impact, but let me explain something. Back in 2009, the cost for appeals was $50. And in order to raise revenues for the courts, we raised it to $85, a $35 increase, a 70% increase. Currently, we are at the $85 range, I believe, and we're raising it to $105, I believe, is the difference. Let me verify this. I'm sorry, it's $185 to $205. It's a $20 increase, somewhere in the range of about 19%. I have some concerns with the ability for us to go through, because when you talk about access to justice, I do agree to you. We need to have access to justice. That's part of the reason that we're doing this bill in general. And so I am somewhat torn on this fee. I guess I will just point out, in my opinion, the hypocrisy of the fact that in 2009 we raised these. And I will say that we will hopefully not fall into the same trap. And so I will encourage my colleagues to support this amendment.
This bill breaks fees down in 5 divisions. The 4th division of this bill is for more common violations, including those for drivers. Speeding violations will be $5 to $30 more. Seatbelt violation is $15 more and $70 more for failure to prove insurance. It also covers hunting violations. The bill's 5th division increases misdemeanor and felony fines. A Class C's minimum penalty increases by $370 and its maximum by $3,000. Senator Hoag says he isn't supporting the bill because it disproportionately affects people making less money.
Make no mistake, this is a significant fee increase on Iowans, many of whom are not in a position to pay it. So you make your budget decisions. I know you're all, you know, lathered up about a massive tax cut, but now you're sticking it on the backs of ordinary Iowans. And even on the criminal surcharge, there are a lot of very poor people who are going to be paying however you think you might have improved the presentation of those fines, they're going up.
Senator Chelgren says the fees will help fund worthwhile programs.
We're dealing with the Victims Compensation Fund seeing an increase of $370,000. We're seeing the Criminalistics Laboratory Fund at $2.1 million. We're seeing $4.4 million additional to the Court Technology Fund.
The bill increasing penalties for fines passes 45-4. Opposing are Democrats Rob Hoag, Tony Bisignano, Rich Taylor, and Republican Jake Chapman. It now must go before the House of Representatives. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly legislative podcast from Iowa Public Radio. I'm John Pimble.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
One of the most controversial bills of this two-year General Assembly is ready to be signed into law. This week alone, it had 8 hours of debate between both chambers. Part of this bill would remove state funding to entities like a city declaring itself to be a sanctuary city. The definition of what a sanctuary city is varies, but basically it's a jurisdiction, like a city or a county, that makes policy not to assist federal law enforcement when it comes to questioning a person's citizenship and calling federal agents in who could deport them. One of President Donald Trump's first executive orders was to deny funding to jurisdictions that pass such rules. The state of California, for example, is considered a sanctuary state. In 2017, Senate File 481 passed. It was amended this week in the House, mostly as the same bill. Representative Stephen Holt is the bill's floor manager.
It restricts a local entity from adopting or enforcing policy that would prohibit or discourage the enforcement of immigration laws. It prevents local entities from prohibiting or discouraging inquiries about immigration status of a person under lawful arrest.
When a person is arrested and the local law enforcement questions a person's citizenship, they can contact Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This federal organization is referred to as ICE. If ICE is unsure of an arrested person's citizenship, they can request the person be detained 48 hours past the time they may be otherwise released. This is called a detainer. This process applies to people who are arrested and may end up not being guilty of a crime, but it opens the door for a federal agency to question if they are an illegal immigrant if this is suspected after the arrest. This Iowa bill formalizes the information local law enforcement already can share with ICE.
It prevents local entities from prohibiting or discouraging exchanging information with another local entity or federal or state entity. It also prevents local entities from prohibiting or discouraging the assistance and cooperation with a federal immigration officer as is reasonable or necessary. It prevents local entities from prohibiting or discouraging permitting a federal immigration officer from entering to conduct lawful enforcement activities at a jail or other detention facility. These are all traditional levels of cooperation that take place every day across the nation and across most areas of Iowa. Senate File 481 requires that law enforcement agencies formalize policies in writing to comply with this chapter. It prohibits discrimination based on race, skin color, language, spoken, or national origin. And it provides protections for victims and witnesses of crime. It allows questioning of witnesses and victims of crime to relate only to the investigation of the alleged offense.
Representative Bruce Hunter says this bill has origins of then-presidential candidate Donald Trump.
This actually started a campaign. They're not our friends, believe me, Donald Trump said. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. Thus started a mantra that is carried through the Iowa legislature that has culminated in Senate File 481, which would direct local governments to comply with federal immigration authorities or risk losing state funding. Because, as Representative Holt so eloquently declared in committee, sanctuary cities place the interests of illegal immigrants ahead of their own citizens.
Hunter says this bill isn't necessary because there are no sanctuary cities in Iowa.
I'm not even sure that they would be legal if a sanctuary city got set up here. But there are none. None. Nada. Nothing. There have been no official actions taken by any city in Iowa to designate themselves as a sanctuary city.
But Representative Holt says a resolution passed last year in Iowa City is a reason to be concerned.
I believe suggests defiance of the rule of law that could potentially place citizens and our immigrant population at risk. And the statement that concerns me in that resolution is as follows. Except as necessary for public safety, as determined by the police chief or designee, or as otherwise required by state or federal law, the Iowa City Police Department shall not undertake any law enforcement action for the purpose of detecting the presence of undocumented persons or devote any public resources to the enforcement of immigration law, unquote. Under this resolution, I'm deeply concerned that the police chief could simply determine that cooperating with immigration authorities and honoring detainer requests is not necessary for public safety, that information sharing is not essential.
Representative Wes Breckenridge, a retired police officer, says suggesting law enforcement isn't doing its job is offensive.
I think that every law enforcement agency I've come in contact with, which is quite a few, we enforce the law, we do it by the book, we follow state and federal code when we do it. Your frustration, by some, I believe, is due to maybe some cities creating resolutions or claiming themselves welcoming cities. You're taking that action out against law enforcement, the ones that where the rubber meets the road and is doing the job.
The death of Sarah Root is often brought up. She is from Council Bluffs, but was killed in Nebraska by a drunk driver who was an illegal immigrant. He wasn't held for questioning by federal officials and has since fled with his whereabouts unknown to law enforcement. Representative John Jacobson supports this bill in part because of her death from an illegal immigrant's actions.
This gentleman was a two-time repeat offender. He had not shown for two previous criminal hearings. And had he been detained or deported, as should have happened, had ICE and the locals worked together, Sarah probably would be alive. In any case, he jumped on a low bail because ICE and the locals screwed up their communications somehow, and he was not detained even for the, not unlimited, but the 48-hour period before due process kicks in. So everybody was to blame at all levels. So we're talking about saving lives here, all lives. And Sarah, although this accident happened across the river, one big metro area, Sarah's family does not want her life to be in vain. They're not married just to their legislative district. They want to save all lives.
Representative Beth Wessel-Crochelle says only one group is in support of this bill and cites the religious organizations opposing it.
If you look through the lobbyist declarations, I see such fervent opposition from large religious groups, the Episcopal Diocese, the Methodists, the Catholics, the Interfaith Alliance, strong opposition from religion.
Representative Skyler Wheeler supports this bill and challenges religions who are opposed.
I would challenge them on Romans 13. I would challenge them on what the role of the government is according to the Bible. The role of the government, according to the Bible, very simply, is to punish evil and reward good. This bill is very consistent with Romans 13.
Representative Sharon Steckman also brings up the Book of Romans after Representative Wheeler's comments.
And you know, Representative Wheeler quoted the Bible, Romans 13, but he didn't finish that quote, and I'd like to finish it. And whatever other command there be, are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law.
Representative Ruth Ann Gaines also brings religion into this debate.
I'll sit down and I'll watch the bill pass, and I will think to myself, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do.
This is a long debate with 23 representatives rising in opposition, all Democrats. At the end, during closing remarks, Senator Stephen Holt addresses some of them.
Representative Russell Cashel, you talked about all the groups opposed to this legislation. There's a big group, they're not a lobby group, that supports this legislation. That's the people of Iowa and the people of the United States, 80% of whom in any poll taken says that they understand that catch and release policies of sanctuary cities lead to bad things happening.
Holt also cites statistics of violent crime from illegal immigrants.
Consider some statistics that highlight the need for cooperation between local, state, and federal authorities in the enforcement of immigration laws. And I have no idea what color these people are in these statistics. I have no idea, and I don't care, because this is about the rule of law, not about the color of someone's skin. The Office of Immigration Statistics states, of 188,382 illegal aliens deported in 2011, 23% or over 43,000 had committed criminal traffic offenses, mostly driving under the influence, which puts people at risk. Another 23% or over 43,000 of those deported in 2011 were convicted of drug offenses. The violent crime category of assault, robbery, sexual assault, and family offenses was 12% or over 22,000 of those deported in 2011. Secure Communities was a 2008 through 2014 program under the Obama administration, administered by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that attempted to make best use of resources by identifying and prioritizing which illegal aliens posed the biggest threat to public safety so that they could be deported first. From 2008 to 2011, their data shows 8,500 drunk driving offenses and 6,000 drug-related offenses. Their records also showed major criminal offenses, which included murder, battery, rape, kidnapping, and nearly 3,000 thefts. And 2% of the crimes included child molestation, lynching, and torture.
After citing more statistics, Holt says not all illegal immigrants are a danger.
The majority of immigrants that are here illegally just came here for a better life. And those are not who we're talking about here. We're talking about individuals who have committed additional crimes and traditional cooperation with law enforcement. Because there are individuals here illegally with violent criminal pasts that are disobeying other laws and placing citizens and their fellow immigrants at risk through dangerous disregard for the law. Iowans understand that the rule of law keeps their families, their children, and their communities safe. And despite efforts to muddy the water, Iowans understand the difference between legal immigration and illegal immigration. For the safety of our communities, I move Senate File 481 be read for the last time and placed on its passage.
The bill passes 55 to 45, mostly on party lines. Five Republicans vote against, and one Democrat votes for. During a debate, a legislator has to stay on the topic of the bill, but at the end of the day, they are able to talk freely on the floor during a point of personal privilege. A minute after the Sanctuary Cities Bill passes, Representative Fakeo Abdul-Samad uses this opportunity to harshly criticize the bill.
When I just listened to my friend, Representative Holt, and listened to him cite about individuals who have committed crimes, It like broke my heart. Because I listened to him paint a picture. And I have to go with what Representative Gaines said, that forgive them, Father, because they know not what they do. I thank you for that, because the paint a picture that was just painted in this chamber was so racist. And I mean, it really was. And most of you may not understand that. But it was so rare. It's just like if I stand up here, where's my list about all the mass murder? If I stand up here and talk about, you know what, in the murders in this country, we had race victims of whites of total 3,005. Out of those, 2,509 white males killed folk. When we stand up here and talk about sex victims, we talk about 3,976, 1,739 white folk killed folk. Now, if I did that, y'all would look at my, well, you know, crime goes all over. But we just stereotyped a race of people here. And we did it in a way of passing a bill talking about safety. We talked about protecting folk. Dr. King tomorrow was shot in Memphis, Tennessee, because he talked about what all we had to do was come together and be able to work as a nation, not to divide one another. I heard individuals quoting the Bible today. And it reminded me so much when people would get up in these chambers and talk about slavery and everything else. They quoted the Bible when they hung black folk. They quoted the Bible when they want to perpetuate racism. We didn't talk about the Klan here today, which black folk don't have any membership in. Latinos have no membership in. But we know that blacks and Latinos and people of color have been killed here. And that's what Dr. King lost his life for. We sit here and we quote Hamilton and we quote all the fathers that have come, all of them who owned slaves. All of them who permitted slaves to be done. And when they were talking about justice in the Constitution of the United States, they were talking about white folk. They weren't talking about black folk, because black folk were considered three-fifths of a human being. Listen to what we're doing here. Listen to what we're actually saying to individuals and to babies. Listen to what we're actually selling. The American people were selling Iowans. When you turn around and look at it, let's quote some statistics. Las Vegas shooting, white male, Stephen, 59 people he killed. Orlando, we look at Virginia Tech shooting, white, 33. Sandy Hook, white male, Adam, 28 people killed. Sutherland Springs Church shooting, 27 people killed, white male. We can go down the list of white males that are killed. What are we doing now? What legislation are we going to come up with now? We have people that have died. You have worked hard to be legislators here to talk about justice. You have been worked hard here to talk about us all coming together and working together. Look at the bill that we just passed. Listen to the way things were cited. And Representative Holt, I know you meant no harm. I know it's your conditioning. And that's not being offensive to you. But that's saying we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do in Iowa, because if I'm your brother, you got to understand me. You got to understand, as you quoted those statistics, I was sitting here damn near in tears listening to you quote statistics about all individuals of immigration and how you call them aliens. Nobody said phone home. These are undocumented individuals. We didn't even give them the respect that is to be given, because we don't know, because we don't understand. We have people that died left and right, from Emmett Till to a whole lot of other folk. And we knew the bill was going to pass. But do we have to demonize people to be able to pass bills? Is that what this country stands for? Do we have to demonize individuals to be able to get our point across? That's what Iowa stands for? We talk about Iowa nice. How nice were we today? Iowa nice? What the hell does it mean Iowa nice? When we took children that sit up in here to look for us to do what was right and watch their foreparents, their parents demonize. What does that mean for us as individual legislators? Each one of us need to go home and look at it, because each one of us in this room are immigrants. Your forefathers weren't here. They came on a boat. Know your own history. They came on a boat.
Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad, during a point of personal privilege, after a long debate about the enforcement of immigration laws in Iowa. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pemble. This week, the Iowa Ombudsman released a scathing report about Iowa's privatized Medicaid system. A committee moved a bill forward that may help. It requires the Department of Human Services to review any case where the private insurance company, known as an MCO or managed care organization, cuts services to a client. If a patient wins an appeal, Representative Dave Heaton says the DHS will step in.
Anytime there is an appeal and our client prevails, the decision on the services continued will rely with the department and not with the MCO. I think we need to make sure that we have covered that.
It also states private companies must comply with contracted deadlines for paying providers. An independent auditor will randomly review the payments. This series is coming to a close with the General Assembly projected to end by April 17th. Projected means just that. It can be sooner or it can go longer. As I continue this weekly show, I'm always relying on a great staff for help. Joyce Russell is at the State House every day. Thank you, Joyce. We also send in Katerina Sestarik. Our talk show producers are working on their own weekly live show that airs Mondays at noon. They are Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. Radio Iowa's Kay Henderson is a wealth of advice and never says no when we ask her for a favor. Thank you, Kay. Catherine Perkins is Iowa Public Radio's news program director. News director Michael Leland gives edits and guidance to the show. The season has a lot going on, and you can review many of the issues by listening to our previous 12 episodes from this year at iowapublicradio.org, the IPR app, and by subscribing to the show through iTunes or your favorite podcast browser. Our next show comes out on Friday. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.